This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. This is the show where we talk about spirituality and sexuality for our community.
Good evening, faithful listeners. You're listening to the Spirit Lounge here on Joy 94.9 every Thursday from 8 until 9. Tonight I am joined by Rachel. Hi.
Hi.
And tonight our guest is going to be Nivi Balachandran. Hello, Nivi.
Hello.
Now, we've had Nivi a few times on before and we'll be interviewing her a little more closely later about the organisation she's a part of. It's called United Religions Initiative, as well as the fact that she's been on some very interesting trips related to that to Cambodia. I looked up this week, we do the holy day of the week every week where we try and talk about upcoming events, and this week's one I thought was something a little bit different, but I thought it would still be something important to still talk about. This week's holiday is actually L. Ron Hubbard's birthday is what we're going to be talking about, L. Ron Hubbard being the founder of the Church of Scientology. So, Rachel, you looked up a little bit about this.
Yeah, so L. Ron Hubbard does actually fall under a religious holiday, the celebration of his birthday, because the entire Scientology church does celebrate. So, L. Ron Hubbard's birthday is the 13th of March. I nearly said of May. All my M's getting confused. So, just a little bit of background. He was an author as well as the founder of the Church of Scientology.
Yeah, he's a science fiction writer.
Yes, he's quite well known. So, for his birthday, more than 4,500 Scientologists from 40 nations gathered for the annual gala celebration of L. Ron Hubbard's birthday, which was held in Clearwater, Florida, which is home of the Church of Scientology's spiritual headquarters.
So, back up. This was, I believe, last year's.
This was last year's birthday, yes. So, we haven't heard quite about how dramatic his celebrations are going to be this year, but I'm sure if we look it up in a few days' time, we'll definitely hear all about that one.
Yeah, so it seems that it's an extended time. So it actually seems to be, to the best of my understanding of when I looked up, it's not necessarily that they're celebrating Hubbard's birthday specifically, but that it's an opportunity to talk about it, to sort of talk about the church as a whole and its growth and other things that they might want to.
Yeah, so it's like say. It's his birthday week, so they do these parties ongoing and whatnot, and they take it as a chance to celebrate Scientology as a religion. Dare we say?
Yeah, and it's also my understanding that while officially people are actually not supposed to celebrate his birthday, people kind of do anyway sometimes is a bit of my understanding. So I saw here someone was writing about that regardless of Hubbard's request to not be celebrating his birthday once he died, some Scientologists still throw large parties to celebrate it anyway. And again, they more are about commemorating events within Scientology and its growth, and I think it's tied to that, you know, he still is the founder of the religion, so we do want to commemorate its growth and things like that.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess they don't get the chance to celebrate any other religious holidays within Scientology, so it's their one chance to take a day off and have a party, right?
No, yeah. And look, I'll back up a little and say that I imagine probably some people listening and, you know, even myself to some degree, it's a bit like, should we even be, is it even appropriate for me to even mention Scientology in this context and stuff like this? And that is, it is a bit of a challenge. It's worth noting. And It actually just reminds me, I remember when I was in high school, of course, people are, you know, very passionate about things in high school. And I remember once I had a bunch of friends that said, hey, we're going to go to the anti-Scientology rally, and do I want to come? And I was kind of in this weird... tear, right? So basically, I mean, I will come clean and say that, you know, there's a lot about Scientology that makes me very uncomfortable, and in a way that's quite different to the way other religions might make me feel uncomfortable. Yeah. And fine. But at the same time, there was something to me, and I don't know if it's because of my Jewish heritage or anything like that, where I just said, I don't know how I feel about rallies against a religion as a whole. I don't know if maybe that it's not... Maybe it's not the same, and I'm sure some people are going, yeah, but do you understand what they're like, and that sort of thing. But I feel like even if that is the case, I feel like things like rallies and sort of the aim to fight something by in that sort of way, it doesn't make me feel comfortable. I'm not sure it's the right way to go about those things.
Understandable.
Yeah, and I don't know, maybe it's even a case of that, maybe I guess if people are worried about what certain groups might be doing to its members, it's more about helping them as opposed to trying to demonize
the religion.
That, yeah. Not only, because, I mean, that alone would backfire. Like, we basically know that from throughout history.
Definitely. Let's make some Scientology support groups for people who need to get out of the church.
Yeah, maybe. But anyway, I thought it was... definitely, I think it was worth talking about this this week, because we didn't really quite have anything fitting in, even though we do have... The closest that we have is St. Patrick's Day that's coming up as a holiday.
Next week, St. Patrick's
Day. That's right. Maybe? I think we'll maybe talk about that a little bit more that week.
About leprechauns and rainbows. Rainbows, is that
that's
right?
Yeah, I'm sure that's all there is to it, right?
Definitely. That's isn't the point.
But no, thank you for listening to our slightly different and smaller holy day of the week. Good evening. You're listening to the Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. We do have someone writing in just saying, agree, Tal. Rallies against other religions are very dangerous. Thank you for your comment. I mean, thank you for agreeing with me. I always like that. Yeah, I mean, we were talking a little bit off air. Let's go back to this for a moment. We were talking a little bit off air. Nivi, you were also, I guess, felt a bit the same way, right?
Well, yes. I mean... I'm someone who does a lot of interfaith, wear many different hats doing interfaith. So, look, not that I want to get into the merits about exactly why people feel uncomfortable with religion X or religion Y. It's just that, it is quite important to be respectful of people's beliefs and understand, especially I think what you said about, you know, we may be uncomfortable, but what makes us uncomfortable with Scientology is the same thing that made people uncomfortable about ex-religion 100 years ago. And it's the new kid on the block. And I think whenever a religion is newer, somehow we subject it to rationality, and we don't really do that with religion that came before time or was older than any sort of memory. And... it's just, I always find it really interesting because even in interfaith, people will be like, oh, Scientology. And I'm just like, I don't know, people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, well, you know?
Especially when, you know, I think we still see that with maybe, you know, it's like you have some people who are like, Scientology's not okay. Then some people think Mormonism is okay and some people don't. And then I'm already like, why? Apart from the fact that they make you uncomfortable, they're new and, you know, in different sort of places around the world, we don't see that. But the Baha'i are then subjected to that exact same sort of thing. But I mean, it's fair. I mean, many people bring forward criticisms that are much more heavy hitting than what we might have. Yeah, for example, exactly saying that, you know, people take from their members and are really stealing, in a sense, brainwashing them, stealing from people, and then sort of it's all going into people making a lot of money. I just bring that up.
There's Australian churches as well that are guilty of doing the same thing.
Yeah. So. I mean, if we sit and think about it too much, every religion comes with so much baggage, doesn't it?
You'll just go in circles.
Well, exactly. And it's definitely not to say that I don't want to establish a precedent by let's not go after Scientology because I don't want anyone looking in my backyard. But it's just more, I guess, it's just one of those funny little inconsistencies.
But there's also another precedent that we could be sending by saying, well, this one's really bad
exactly.
for even when it's similar type of things. And like I said, it's that element of when we sort of pick on a particular, I mean, that I guess makes us feel good in terms of digging into the one that we're like, it's a weird cult. It's not very helpful to people that who we supposedly actually want to be helping.
Yeah, right.
To be marginalizing their newfound faith. Thank you. So, I mean, Nivi has been brought in here for a moment. She's been thrusted in. We are talking to Nivi Balachandran. Hello, Nivi.
Hello, everyone. Hello.
Now, we'll begin, because you went to Cambodia, you know, different issues like that. Maybe we'll open by saying, you know, why did you go to Cambodia? Because it's very relevant.
Right. So, I work for a global grassroots interfaith organization by the name of the United Religions Initiative, and its goal really is to build bridges through projects of different religious and spiritual groups. And really it's predicated on the idea that you know, there is a lot of baggage between people of different religions in terms of conflict, or whether it be historical grievances or forced conversions or exclusive truth claims, and whether we agree with it or not, religion does continue to play a very big part in a lot of people's lives. And it's not just people of religions, different ideologies as well. So we were there, I was part of that organization meeting in Southeast Asia to kickstart our projects in the region, which is exciting.
Maybe we'll back up. You use the term exclusive truth claim. It's a term I use as well. And for maybe some people, I think sometimes it can be a bit of an interfaith claim. Can you maybe elaborate a bit about what that means?
Sure. Well, that just essentially means that the religion you believe in has a statement along the lines of, it's our way only. It's this God, this prophet, that's it.
This practice, this whatever.
Yes, yes. I'm just simplifying it into a soundbite.
Okay, so, and is that a problem in interfaith?
It just more, when you do interfaith, I think it depends on what you want to get out of it. Like, if you want to sit down and have a proper theological exchange of ideas, you know, that's one, you know, that can... It's not necessarily a problem, because we all understand that religions have different claims. But if you're someone who's looking just to come to a gathering because you just want people to get along, and then somebody walks in and says, really, but it's my way though, that can be a problem. So it's really more just you have to clarify objectives as to why you're doing the interfaith in the first place. But largely, no, it can sometimes function as a barrier for people who do have those beliefs, who feel like interfaith is a waste of time. But it's really great just to get people in the room so we can start having those conversations.
So, you were in Cambodia as part of organizing something quite large. So it wasn't really about Cambodia itself.
No. So, for example, I work for the URI across Australia, New Zealand, and the Pacific Islands, and then I have a counterpart who works in Cambodia for Cambodia, Malaysia, Thailand, and Indonesia, and then we have one regional coordinator for the Philippines, because there's so much activity and it's such a diverse group happening there. So, and then we have the global support team in California. So you can imagine it's quite hard for us to all get together. So especially when we were just kickstarting the new work in Southeast Asia, Cambodia was chosen because it's a central location for everyone, and because
especially for California.
Yeah. for the team that'll continue doing the work. Yeah. It's a central location, but really because it was our way of saying that, you know, we're committing to Cambodia and we want to be able to help you know, foster interfaith cooperation in that country.
So then what sort of work, interfaith work, are we seeing in Cambodia?
Well, it's very much at the beginning, and Cambodia, touchwood, has a society that isn't very divided along religious lines. It's a predominantly Buddhist country, but as everyone in Cambodia will tell you, when we say Buddhism, we mean a mix of Hinduism and Buddhism because of Cambodia's history. So it's very, very diverse in that sense. It's got a rich heritage of cultural practices that fall under that umbrella of Buddhism. There are various Christian groups there as well, and we have a small Muslim community there as well. So because of Cambodia's history, a lot of tragic things have taken place. So you can imagine religious difference is not the forefront of people's minds. So Cambodia is a country that's growing very quickly, developing very quickly. It's got a huge international sector present there. There's a lot of foreign money. So, yeah, religion is, luckily, it's a sticking point rather than a dividing point.
So does this then reflect, you were talking on that, when you say we call it Buddhism, but it's kind of a bit of a mix and it's sort of Hindu Buddhism, sort of. So this is part of my understanding. My understanding is that Buddhism is a non-theistic religion.
Right.
That, yeah, and you certainly might hear, maybe this is more because I speak to more hippie converts to Buddhism that are from Australia and from America, maybe it's because of that, but they talk about that there's like no God in Buddhism and different like that. And even when I talk to other people, that is really the best of my understanding. But then I talk to Buddhists who are from Southeast Asia and you say, what do you believe? And they're like, number one, God.
Right.
Is that where this is coming from?
Well, it's super interesting because if you think about it, so the South Indian Chole dynasty spread throughout Southeast Asia. So that's why we call that area Indochina largely, because it was the spread of South Indian culture throughout Southeast Asia. So that whole area was Hindu once upon a time. So Buddhism also arose out of India and then spread also throughout Southeast Asia. And what happened is, if you can imagine that Hinduism set up the infrastructure, so it didn't not only just literally set up the spiritual infrastructure, but it was very much almost it wasn't a substitution, it was an amalgamation of ideas. So you can imagine that one layer of paint was laid down and then another colour washed over. And it washed over in such a way that the colours have mixed. So in Hinduism, if you look at the far point of Hinduism that arose in contemporary time that Buddhism came around, it's known as Hindu non-duality. The similarities between Hindu non-duality and Buddhism are very, very, very similar, except for the idea of God. So God has been moved out of the picture in Buddhism, and it remained in India. So if you look at Cambodia in particular, I'll speak about Cambodia because I've actually been there, it's got that really rich heritage. So a lot of the practices, we call it Buddhism, but it's really got that almost people, it's like God's still there, we just call it a different name. And it's not so much about people are sitting down and studying these books and looking at Tibetan Buddhism versus Theravada Buddhism or Mahayana traditions. They're just, you know, they go to the temple and they pray in a way that's really similar to the way Hindus pray, because I'm a Hindu, so it was very familiar. And all of our tour guides would tell us, well, look, we call it Buddhism, but it's Hinduism and Buddhism mixed.
You say that, then how do Hindus pray then, if you want to that stuck out for you?
Yeah, well, it's actually more the ceremonies around prayer. So when we go to a temple, for example, you'll go and you'll perform prayers in front of a representation of God. And often what you'll have with you is a plate with different things on it, like different powders or different fruits. And it's almost like an offering, and you'll have your incense. And so when I walk, because I've been to many Buddhist temples before in different parts of the world, and I walked in and I look at this plate and I'm just like, oh, that's, I've not actually seen that in many other Buddhists, that almost that very similar setup. So, and then I saw people praying and it's very, very similar. And Buddhism and Hinduism do have a lot of mixed similarities, but you can see that change as you move further east. But when you see it's almost in that Southeast Asia region, it actually still looks the same. Which is when you go further east, it doesn't look the same at all. It's adapted to the cultures in which, like, for example, in China, Japan, and Korea, it's extremely different. But if you look at it in Southeast Asia, it's like, oh my gosh, like, I could almost jump right in and participate. And the other thing that I heard was, Khmer, which is my understanding of how Cambodians pronounce Khmer, like the language. Yep. So when you hear the prayers, I thought I was listening to Sanskrit prayers, and it is a language derived from Sanskrit back in the day, but the chanting was so similar. And I was like, oh my goodness, because if you kind of heard Sanskrit prayers once on a tape and you heard this, you really wouldn't know that you're hearing a different. And there were Buddhist prayers as well. So that was just, these are things, for example, I've seen in other forms of Buddhism and not seen anything like it so similar to how we practice.
It sounds to me even similar to when I was in Thailand. I mean, I wasn't exactly engaging so much with religious subtlety when I was in Thailand. I was spending much more time partying. However, I noticed very much that we have what is often referred to very It's very, if you think about Thailand and you think about traditional culture of Thailand, you sort of have the dances of women, and they sort of, one stands one behind the other so that they have many arms, and it's really, really cool. And they have these big golden hats. They get like incredible headdresses, mm-hmm. I guess is the way to put it. It's not a hat. This, maybe you know, is this, to me, I look at that and it looks Hindu to me.
So it's, well, I'll start with the dancing first. So I was born in Australia but did a lot of different Indian classical dancing, South Indian. So you can imagine when I first started seeing these sorts of things in Bali and Thailand and Cambodia, I was like, oh, that looks really familiar. And I'm sitting there like a 12-year-old, have no idea or any sophisticated understanding about anything. And then years later, and I go to Cambodia and I've been looking and reading, and they're all very South Indian influenced. You know, South Indian Hindu culture is very different from North Indian Hindu culture, for example. So that's why I keep emphasizing, because there were different dynasties and different kingdoms, and it was the culture of South India that spread throughout Southeast Asia. So they are very similar. But however, I mean, if you look at, you know, Mahayana Buddhism, there are many different representations of the Buddha, and if you trace the way the Buddha is represented, you get the female Buddha with different arms and different forms, and you know, so it is very, like, it's very Buddhist iconography as well. It just bears a lot of similarities to South Indian dancing culture. So I would always, it was always kind of been like a dream of mine to get like a South Indian girl, a Balinese girl, a Thai girl, and a Cambodian girl doing all their dances together, just because I think it would just be so amazing if you just watch them one after the other.
It sounds like a YouTube viral video right there. Got to be done.
Next project.
And you're listening to The Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. We've been talking to Nivi Balachandran about URI and her trip to Cambodia. Well, and sort of we talked about Cambodia, and then we just talked about the history of the relationship between Hinduism and Buddhism, but we are still largely getting there. So speaking of that incredible heritage that's sort of going on there, how well is, because you get to, I mean, when I think of Cambodia, I think of the sort of stuff which is straight out of, what's the advent?
Tomb Raider.
Yeah, like Tomb Raider and like all this total stereo, Indiana Jones, that's what, yes, I'm exactly thinking of. Like all that stuff where it's like temples in the middle of jungles and they're really ancient. Of course, there's always ancient treasures there and boulders might smash you and that sort of thing. But at least that idea of these dilapidated temples with like trees growing through them. And I have seen some photos of places like Angkor Wat. And to some extent, that is kind of what it looks like. But I want, tell us more about
that. That is actually what it looks like. So there's a, so Angkor Wat.
I'll put some photos up on our Facebook page.
Oh, no, you should. Because look, so after the work meeting, I decided I had to take a few extra days to go check out Siem Reap, which is the town closest to all of Cambodia's temples, or a large majority of their ancient temples. And Angkor Wat actually refers to one, the biggest of the temples, and it's a temple complex essentially. But then dotted around that southern part of Cambodia are all these other temples, so many, like too many to count. Some of which are in such states of disrepair, I just don't think they can be salvaged. And you do get the temples in which there is a tree growing through the temple. One major part of a wall is a tree. And this is going to sound so strange, but the trees in Cambodia are not like anything else I've ever seen. They have like arms and limbs and feet and toes and hands. Like they look like hands growing. So where, because a lot of these trees, their roots will be visible, whereas all of our trees, the roots are underground. So imagine if you could just see the roots and you can see what these trees are doing. It's just incredible. So a lot of these temples were just lost to the jungle for a long time. So by the time people started rediscovering Cambodia's history, you could just have to almost part the trees to find these ancient, beautiful. It's such a sight. I really recommend going because it's hard to describe, but like Tal said, he'll pop some photos up because it's just incredible. It's just amazing.
So how well these different temples maintained? I mean, can people go visit them?
People can go visit them. So Cambodia, as I think probably most people will know, suffered through the Khmer Rouge in the 70s. And not only was, you know, almost a quarter of the population slaughtered, and it was also when the Khmer Rouge were coming around, their goals, they established year zero, and they really wanted to rid the country of its colonial influences and any sort of its anything they thought were holding its people back. And besides killing people who were educated or spoke a foreign language, they also sort of went after the country's spiritual infrastructure, which means that so these temples, which have survived centuries upon centuries, that survived the jungle taking them over, were actually only recently destroyed in the 70s by the Khmer Rouge. Where, and I found this actually quite distressing, because you'd walk into Angkor Wat and you'd see a Buddha statue, which has been, the head has been chopped off. It's not broken off, or it's been sliced off, or the arms have been cut off. And look, when heads have been cut off, there were a lot of treasure raiders in the 70s who took advantage of Cambodia just being in chaos. And people came along and said, look, I'd really like that XYZ head from this temple. And they were chopped off. And then you'd see like the famous iconography that's carved into the walls of Angkor Wat has been deliberately cut out and sold to people. So those are still sitting in someone's private collection somewhere all around the world.
Wow.
And it's quite distressing. But then you see other destruction, which is not to take something, it's just to destroy it. So you'll see arms cut off, things cut off, just deliberately destroying because it represents religion, which according to that communist philosophy was just not what Cambodia needed anymore. And as a human being who's in, you know, it's our heritage, it's the world's heritage, it's Cambodia's heritage, and as a Hindu, I found it very hard, because you walk in and for some reason, I think I was probably just living in La La Land. I didn't realize a lot of this stuff had happened. So I thought things were in pretty good condition and it was all going to be, I don't know what I was thinking, because obviously these are ancient ruins, right? They're not perfectly preserved palaces or temples. They are ancient ruins. So they reflect that damage, but they also reflect a much more sinister kind of damage, which is deliberate destruction. And given what we've seen in Iraq in recent weeks, it just brings up like the humanity's heritage and how so many different ways and under so many different names we destroy it when it's such a loss to the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to, let's say, sort of, you know, there was used to be the giant candelabra in ancient Jerusalem, and it's gone, right? These are these ancient artifacts that have never, you know, everyone, there's always that idea of what if we, like, found the Ten Commandments, all that sort of stuff. They are gone. They will probably never be found. That's the reality. But it's another thing when it's things that we had, and they're gone just as of, like, 30 years ago. Even, and exactly what you said, I watched the video, so if people have seen in ISIS in these, it was in Iraq.
In Iraq, yeah.
It basically went to these museums that have these ancient Babylonian, or maybe it was, I think in that case it was Persian. They had the Persian statues, and they were just smashing them with mallets and stuff like that, and it's just awful.
Yeah.
And there's an ancient town that's also, and when I say ancient, I mean like the walls are like more than 1,000 years old, and it's just been like bold, it's just gone, and
yeah,
it's just appalling. I can't
see, that almost brings me back to the rallying against other religions as well. So, like, what? Yeah, it's like ruining something that is special to them, whether it's pointless and a nothing item to you, to somebody else in that religion. That's a very important piece of their history.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And so, I mean, with what happened in northern Iraq, it's you know, these cultures and civilizations have passed into antiquity. And you've just destroyed human history. You've destroyed, like, these amazing preservations of human ingenuity and history. And in Cambodia, like, so I have to say, it's not just recent destruction. So this is just goes to show you what religions and civilizations are like at times. So because Cambodia back in, like, the 13th, like, 11th, 12th, 13th century chopped and changed between being Buddhist and being Hindu, so you have temples that were built by Hindu kings or Buddhist kings, and then the next religion came in and then tried to change those temples. So you've got this really horrible example where in one of the temples, and the names escape me because there are so many and I don't have a list. So there's one temple where the I guess there was a Buddhist temple, so it had a statue of Buddha, right? And then the Hindu king comes in and then changes it to a Shiva Linga, which is like that long rock, cylindrical rock. And because, you know, he's a Hindu and he wants it to be a Shiva temple. And then the Buddhist king comes back and, oh, a different Buddhist king comes back and then chops down the Shiva Linga. And now what do you have? Just broken pieces of stone instead of what should be bits of heritage. So it's not just people coming in, reached up, like, you know, there are wars and people do silly things. And I guess what strikes me is that we never learn our lesson. So whether it's what's happened in Iraq or what happened in Cambodia, what, you know, the Taliban bombing the Buddhist statues in Afghanistan in 2002, like, we just keep doing it. It's just crazy. It's quite disheartening.
And it's actually amazing that people still keep their faith even when these horrible things are happening to their religion. Like, they're being solely targeted based on their religion. So imagine being that original Buddhist temple and the Hindu king coming in and, like, as the Buddhist, what do you do? What do you have left to stand on if you can't, you know, protect your own religion?
Well, exactly. And then you've got temples that were built by Hindu kings and the opposite happens. And it's just all this silly nonsense where, and especially for two religions that are so similar. Like, I laugh as a Hindu. I'm just like, it's so short-minded and it's so awful. But then you get these temples where one was started by one religion and then finished by another and they kind of reflect both. And that's really cool. You kind of see these fusion temples. The other thing was interesting in Cambodia is that a lot of money needs to go into restoring these things, right? And Cambodia is a developing country and it has a lot of natural resources, but a lot of the money is not necessarily being spent on restoration. So you have different countries coming in who, like, almost these bilateral restoration partnerships where Japan has come in and done some amazing restoration work at some of the temples, and India is now getting involved with one temple, and I saw the signs in Hindi at the temple, and you can imagine, I was like, wait, what? And then you see, you know, for example, the Czech Republic is doing restoration on one temple, and you get, you know, UNESCO obviously doing some restoration. So it's interesting, but one temple that I saw was just like rubble. And I guess that happens.
Yeah. So I've forgotten my question. I had a really good question and now I've completely lost
it. That's all right. It can be just so awful to hear those sort of things. I mean, I don't want to make it about, you know, it's not about me and those different sort of things, but it's nice sometimes though when it sort of turns out all right, you know, when you hear about the fusion temple, that's so much nicer than the one that's had one crushed one after the other.
Well, I saw, so there's a lot of that, I have to say. There is a lot of destruction. So one's done one's destroyed it. But you will see how, for example, the religions have melded in Cambodia. And I remember seeing, there's this very, very famous five-headed serpent in Cambodia. It's like a Buddhist icon called Naga. And she's like a five-headed serpent. So the serpent's always at the gate of things. And then you'll see like a mix where there'll be like a Hindu icon and then Naga will be like around. And this is really, like, for example, there's like a turtle. I have a photo of this, which is turtle from like Hindu mythology and like Naga. And they're like, and they were made deliberately together. And I thought that was really amazing because I think, you know, in my mind, it was like the balm that I needed to like salvage the wounds of what I'd seen. And look, hopefully we can preserve that heritage for many generations to come.
And you're on Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. And tonight we're speaking with Nivi. And we would like to know, so what is it that the United Religions Initiative are doing in Australia now?
Well, thank you so much for asking. So URI in Australia is very new. So what we're trying to do is get a lay of the land about the work that's happening to bring people of different cultural and spiritual and ideological backgrounds together to foster stronger understanding and communication and cooperation. So right now my role is very much to talk about URI, so thank you so much for giving me that opportunity. And it's really, really to learn about, so sometimes you can think that just because I've had some experience here, so I know what it should look like. I know what X should look like. But really we're looking for new ideas, new ways of bringing people together. So whether it's explicitly that's the purpose or you guys are rallying around a project and you happen to have a lot of different people from different backgrounds getting involved, So yeah, really, we're just trying to grow the network and encourage people to join, because what we can offer is the opportunity to connect you with people doing peace building and interfaith work in many different countries, 85 different countries and 680 odd organizations and groups of people who are trying to build peaceful communities.
So it sounds less that it's about URI putting on sort of interfaith events itself.
Well, right. So I think initially we'd like to do that, but I don't want to do that until I get a lay of the land and an organized event that actually fills a gap, because otherwise I'm just running another seminar on interfaith breakfast, and we have a lot of those. So we want to try and do something that's actually needed and something that goes beyond just replicating. I think I've said that. So we do hope once we are a more established presence and people know who we are, that we will be able to put on thought-provoking events that build the capacity of people doing the work, but also try and provide some thought leadership and give them a bit of context and connect them to what's happening globally.
It sounds great to have an organization that sort of sits a different level back, per se. You know, we have lots of groups, and I mean, I know working in interfaith, there's really a crazy amount of groups that are actually trying to engage in interfaith. A large amount of them are doing very, very similar work, even in the same even region. And yeah, it would be nice to, it's great to have it sitting where you have someone, you have an organization whose actual job is to get them all to talk.
Well, exactly. So, I mean, URI is based, it's all over the world, and it has a global support office in San Fran. So I'm really just an individual here who is who's looking to provide those connections. So my job is to get to know what's happening and then think creatively and try and connect people doing like-minded work. And I think probably here in Australia, I mean, A, we're a very secular country, and which is great. And so it can sometimes be difficult to get people to understand the importance of interfaith, because nobody's pointing a gun at someone else's head, metaphorically speaking. So we are looking to sometimes help people understand that what happens globally can have a real impact locally. So if you're interested in doing, for example, even if it's international development work and you want to go work somewhere in Uganda, well, we have project partners for people who do peace building in Uganda. So instead of you having to go out and start your own networking creations, we can put you in touch with people who are doing community work in many different countries.
A completely random question. Is the job dangerous? Like, maybe not so much in Australia, but in other countries doing interfaith work, is it a dangerous job to have?
Well, I think it is when it's in a conflict zone. For example, one of the stalwarts of interfaith in Mindanao in the Philippines, which is in the south, which has been a long-standing conflict area, and one of our trustees, who's one of the, on the Global Council and is a leader in Southeast Asia, does work where he's working with rebels and the government and the army and doing work that is quite risky and has traditionally been risky. But, you know, at the same time, you have someone like me who sits in an office, you know, getting to learn and meet new people and learn about new projects. And because URI doesn't have a specific way of doing things. It's a set of values that people ascribe to, like to respect one another, to put peace first, and to not, I guess, run your mouth without thinking. So there's a lot of these values. So, yeah, the work takes so many different forms in so many different parts of the world.
So if someone wanted to get involved, at what point are you getting involved with URI as opposed to just setting up some sort of interfaith organization?
Well, if you are someone who's doing work with a group of people and you all come from different ideological and spiritual backgrounds, and you're interested in kind of learning what else could I be doing, who else could I be working with, what's happening overseas, can I learn from other people in different countries, then URI is an organization you should consider joining. So there's no fees. It's really just our chance is we want to help you do your work. And we don't know what that help will look like until I meet with you and we can talk. But sometimes it's lonely. It's lonely being a grassroots person doing community work, and we're here to try and make it a little bit less lonely.
That's awesome.
So where can they contact you?
Best way to get me is on my email, which is nivy@ uri.org. So just say hi if you want to tell me you heard me through Joy, sure. And I'll be very grateful. And yeah, we'll set up a time to catch up for a coffee and meet each other.
That sounds absolutely fantastic.
And you're on Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9, and we've been talking to Nivi tonight, and I was just going to ask, so what are some of the projects that URI actually are involved with that you help out?
Sure. Well, so our members are doing some absolutely fantastic work. So here in Australia, one of our members is Cultural Infusion, which is a social enterprise, and they run intercultural education programs in many schools across Victoria. They also do big cultural performance stage shows and are going to be heavily involved in Anzac Day this year. So really what they do is try and build intercultural education and understanding through the arts. And then you have an organization like Common, which really brings together women from many different backgrounds, whether they're Aboriginal women or women from, you know, different spiritual faith traditions, and really work on how can they together advocate for issues that they care about, such as the environment, such as women's health, such as mental health. And then you have an organization such as Green Faith, which is involved in advocacy for promoting the environment. And Interaction, which is an organization Tal and I are both involved in, is also a member, and they do a lot of education about the world's religions and leadership training and skills on racism. So you can see it's a very diverse group. And the last one I wanted to mention is an organization called Bumblebee. So that's where a woman named Pauline organizes shipments of goods to countries such as Somalia and the Sudan and the Philippines to do emergency relief work. And also she's very focused on village sustainability, so teaching people how to grow food and how to take care of themselves.
Thank you so much for sharing with us, Nivi. I think it was a very interesting interview. We talked about all sorts of different things. That's right. Well, that's going to be all we've got time for this week on the Spirit Lounge. So hopefully we will hear our, you will listen. We would love to speak to you, all our faithful listeners, next week. I really botched that one up. No, let's not. All right, I botched that one up. I really hope to see you all very, very soon. Thank you so much. That is goodbye from Tal.
Goodbye from Rachel.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.